This morning we're going to continue the series of lessons that we began on Thursday evening. This morning we're going to consider the superiority of Christ over mysticism. This goes hand in hand with the Colossians 2 text that has kind of been the starting point for this series. One of the points that the Apostle Paul makes as he's talking to the Christians in Colossae is that he makes a series of comparisons in the overarching point that Christ is superior to the alternative or the alternatives. And so then he lists some of those as we've pointed out as we've gone through the study and the introduction of each of the lessons. So to one of the points that he makes is he doesn't say it like this, but this is at the heart of it, is mysticism. Of things that are kind of unclear that we're not sure of, and let's not just put the supernatural moniker on it, because the reality is the Holy Spirit is also supernatural. The power of God is supernatural. It's beyond the realm of what we recognize as the norm. We understand the difference between the natural and the supernatural. And so the Apostle Paul appeals to them in that regard, that things not seen, the idea of mystic things that we often refer to as maybe falling into the category of the occult, but it would be broader than that as well. It's always been with us. I have noticed, I am getting to that age where I'm starting to talk back to the TV. You know, are you there yet? If you're not, it's coming. Because I'm getting old enough that I have a broader range of experience in life, and the culture around me has changed from my childhood. And I have noticed in the last 10 years in particular, there is this enormous interest in vampires. Have you noticed this phenomenon? Now, I don't get it, because honestly, when I was a kid, we still had the Bela Lugosi reruns, and I would lay in bed at night with the covers up to about here after watching one of those movies. That just scared me to death. Now, it seems, number one, they're better looking. You know, they are these suave looking dudes that, you know, a beautiful head of hair, beautiful eye, all that kind of. They're good looking guys, but still, it's obvious, and it's nothing new. It may be new to us parents and grandparents, because there was not that fascination when we were kids, but the reality is mysticism has been long with us. Even in the Old Testament, Moses is instructing the people of Israel in regard to their thoughts and their relationship with witchcraft and sorcery and so on and so forth. And so it's been around forever. The writer of Ecclesiastes is exactly right. There is nothing new under the sun. It's just that it's more prevalent sometimes than other times. But it's always there. And so we do live in a world where people might search for answers in mysticism. Whether it be mystic religions, several years ago the New Age movement was a growing, kind of a growing movement, and you know, people were looking at crystals and astrology and things of that nature. So, again, always with us, people will investigate it. The question is, as we go back to that concept that we've studied over and over through the week, Colossians chapter 2, Paul's appeal is, Christ is better than that. And so he does lay out these six objects, these six things, areas, that people have a tendency to try to find the great answers in, and his point overall in Colossians 2 is, Christ is better than that. He recognizes all this because he had to deal with it in his lifetime. He had to deal with this idea of Christ is superior to mysticism. The people that he dealt with, that he taught, that he was bringing to Christ, they were surrounded by this idea of mysticism. And so we're going to look at several passages tonight, this morning, and talk about, demonstrate where Paul dealt with it, demonstrate how he dealt with it, and ultimately come to this conclusion that Christ is superior to mysticism. Again, like all these other things we've dealt with, they come up short when compared to the power of Christ and our relationship with Him. So, let's first begin, if you would, in Acts chapter 13. I want to look at an event on the first missionary journey that the Apostle Paul is involved in, to just first demonstrate Paul's conclusion that Christ and mysticism are incompatible. They don't go together. And now again, it's not the supernatural, because we'll be looking at a moment, we'll be looking at an event in the life of Christ in just a moment that clearly demonstrates that Christ was in control of nature. He performed miracles. There were things that we would say, you know, I can't explain. But he was involved in those miracles in suspending we would say the laws of nature. And so we'll see that in just a moment. But here, what I want you to leave with is Paul making a demonstration that mysticism is incompatible with loyalty to Christ. And so this is on his first missionary journey, very early in the missionary journey. He is on the island of Cyprus. And so let us begin in verse 4. So being sent out by the Holy Spirit, they went down to Seleucia, and from there they sailed to Cyprus, and they arrived in Salamis. They preached the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews. They also had John as their assistant. Now when they had gone through the island of Paphos, they found a certain sorcerer, a false prophet, a Jew, whose name was Bar-Jesus, who was with the proconsul, Sergius Paulus, an intelligent man. This man called for Barnabas and Saul and sought to hear the word of God. But Elymas the sorcerer, for so his name is translated, withstood him, seeking to turn the proconsul away from the faith. Then Saul, who was also is called Paul, filled with the Holy Spirit, looked intently at him and said, O full of all deceit and all fraud, you son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, you will not cease perverting the straight way of the Lord. And now indeed the hand of the Lord is upon you, and you shall be blind, not seeing the sun for a time. And immediately a dark mist fell on him, and he went around seeking someone to lead him by the hand. Then the proconsul believed when he saw what he had done, being astonished at the teaching of the Lord. Now there's a couple of things that I want to point out for you in that specific text. Here you have a case. We could draw all kinds of assumptions, conclusions from what the motivation was on the part of Elymas. We could say, you know, there is another example that the apostles deal with where a man wanted to buy the power to perform miracles. You know, we might assume, well, maybe that was why he stood between Paul and the proconsul. We could maybe assume he just doesn't want to lose his authority or his prestige as a counselor to the proconsul. Who knows? Doesn't make any difference. But it is important for us to recognize that Paul makes in verse 10 a strong case for the inconsistency of this sorcery when compared to the supernatural thing that he is about to do. But it is a supernatural thing that is an extension of God. It is, in other words, it is divine. It is not mysticism. And so, verse 10 demonstrates that incompatibility. Let me also say, he is not dressing him down just from the standpoint, because we could take the generic approach to this and say, Paul's just dressing him down for standing in the way of the proconsul believing, and, you know, and mysticism was just the thing, was kind of incidental to all of this. And I don't think that's it. I don't think that's it. I mean, yes, he's standing in the way of the proconsul believing, but it's something a little bit more specific here, because Paul, it's not just you're standing in the way. When we look at the condemnation of Paul on other false teachers, he says it a little bit differently. Verse 10 is pretty vehement. Oh, full of all deceit and all fraud, you son of the devil. That's powerful language. That's not, Paul reserves this kind of language for just a few throughout the New Testament. Because generally, actually, on just those who are ignorant of the Word of God, Paul is very patient. He doesn't talk like that to those who are lost because of their ignorance. He reserves this kind of language for those who are the deceivers. And so it's broader than this man just standing between the proconsul and truth. Paul's, you son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness. Paul seems to lend some, he's leading some weight. You know, it's one thing for, we'll talk about human religion this morning. It's one thing for false doctrine to be presented. This is the occult. This is the work of Satan. In more of a direct way than what we might think, well, isn't teaching false doctrine the work of the devil too? Yeah, but this is almost a desire to tap into the power of Satan. And so the Apostle Paul comes back and this is strong, strong language that Paul uses against him. You enemy of all righteousness, you will not cease perverting the straight way of the Lord. And I think that last clause lends such great weight to it because I think that's Paul's point. You're using the supernatural to pervert the way of the Lord. It's interesting then that to demonstrate divine power is Paul then turns around and suspends nature, uses the supernatural to perform a miracle, and that miracle produces the desired effect in the proconsul. Now I want you to notice, it's not just the miracle. Verse 12, he says, being astonished at the teaching of the Lord. Now miracles were there for a purpose. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Miracles were there for a specific purpose. And this impressed him. It got his attention, no doubt. Wouldn't it you? You know, if a guy's standing there with his full sight, right next to me, a man who I know has his full sight, and all of a sudden, blind, you've got my attention. You've got my attention. And let me say, that was the purpose of the miracles. One of them. But notice, what converted this man and what changed this man was not just the power of the miracle, it was the teaching of the Lord. That's an important distinction. The miracle got his attention. The teaching of the Lord converted and changed him. And I think that's important for us to recognize. So, incompatible. Paul's great message is that this is incompatible with the work of Christ. Questions or comments before we move on? All right. If you would now, turn over to Luke chapter 8. In Luke chapter 8, we're going to look at an event of Jesus performing a miracle. Lots of miracles throughout the New Testament, obviously. A lot of miracles throughout the Old Testament. Let me say just a word about all of this. There was a specific reason. I know you've studied this in the past. Specific reason. I think it's just important for us to kind of review that, to remember that as we go through the course of this morning's discussion. Miracles were not intended as a carnival sideshow. They were intended primarily, there are some incidental effects to miracles, but primarily they were intended to prove the deity of Christ and by extension for the apostles and those that the apostles laid hands on who had the power to perform those miracles. It was used to demonstrate that they were representatives of God. So that there was a specific proof was the purpose. The reason I say that is because it becomes very easy for people to buy into the idea, particularly with healing, and we see this today. We see this today with the so-called faith healers that you see on the Trinity Broadcast Network and other places. You see this. It's easy to buy into the idea that miracles were performed because Jesus was a compassionate man. And I've watched this process amongst these so-called faith healers. And there is no doubt. Matter of fact, passages tell us that Jesus had compassion on them. But look, if the primary reason for these miracles was compassion, Jesus, in His time, would have emptied the leper colonies. He would have emptied the hospitals. He would have emptied the graveyards if compassion was the purpose. It's not that Jesus looked at a lame man, or looked at a blind man, or looked at a dead child, and didn't have compassion. He did. But He also understands that is nature's process. That is part of nature. Lameness, blindness, death, sickness, that is part of the natural process. He was not there to just suspend that. He wasn't going to take... Look, I am convinced that one of the reasons we don't focus as much in our modern culture on heaven is because we're trying to create our own heaven right here on earth. We try to make things too convenient. I don't think the Lord wanted all of that go to waste. This is a sad substitute for what is waiting for us. And I think there's a reason Jesus didn't go around, you know, lame, walk, blind, see, and just walk down the road healing everyone. There's a reason. There's a reason, because our focus needs to be on the next life, where we could be. This life is a sad substitute for that. And so that's the danger on a kind of a side note. That's a danger for us trying to make this world too good. It's a sad substitute for what is waiting for us. So, let's be clear. Jesus performed miracles. He would be moved with compassion. Clearly, there are two or three times in the Gospels that Jesus is moved with compassion and He will heal somebody. But again, what He doesn't do, again, that wasn't the primary. That was the secondary purpose of that miracle. The primary purpose of that miracle was to demonstrate to those around Him He was the Son of God. He had power over nature. He was deity Himself. And every now and then you'll see the Pharisees where they miss that point. You know, they don't put that together. All they can concentrate on is that He performed a miracle on the Sabbath day. And so they're concentrating on that. So now Jesus is going to perform this miracle. Let me say a word about demonic possession. Just not long ago was asked, said, do you believe in demonic possession? I said, oh, absolutely. The Bible talks all about it. There's no doubt. Right? I mean, we can't deny, if we're going to have faith in this book, we can't deny demonic possession. Question is, does it exist today? I would argue no. And I would argue no because the means by which it can be cast out have been suspended by God as well. But in this day, in this time, I won't say it was common because we've got a few examples of it. I don't think we can say how common it was, but we do have some examples where Christ and His apostles dealt with demonic possession. And so we know it exists, but again, they had the power to do something about it. That does not exist with us today. And so notice beginning in verse 26, this example of Jesus healing this demonic possessed man. Then they sailed to the country of the Gadarenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when He stepped out on the land, there met Him a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time. And he wore no clothes, nor did he live in a house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell down before Him, and with a loud voice said, what have I to do with You, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg You, do not torment me. For He commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For it had often seized him, and he was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, and he broke the bonds and was driven by the demon into the wilderness. Jesus asked him, saying, what is your name? And he said, Legion, because many demons had entered him. And they begged Him that He would not command them to go out into the abyss. Now a herd of many swine was feeding there on the mountain. So they begged Him that He would permit them to enter them, and He permitted them. Then the demons went out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd ran violently down the steep place into the lake and drowned. When those who fed them saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then they went out to see what had happened and came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They also, who had seen it, told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. Then the whole multitude of the surrounding region of the Gadarenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear, and he got into the boat and returned. Now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away saying, "Return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you." And he went his way and proclaimed throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. So the miracle had its effect. We'll talk about it specifically in just a minute, but let's point out the miracle had its effect. It's an interesting effect. I do want you to notice that there are times when Jesus performs a miracle that people are immediately drawn to him. In other words, there are several times that Jesus performs a miracle and to the person he performed the miracle on, he is, "Shh, don't tell anybody." It's also interesting they can't keep their mouth shut. They can't help. And don't get me wrong, I couldn't either. You're blind and from birth, and all of a sudden you can see. That's a hard secret to keep, you know. So inevitably they always run out and say, "Guess what happened to me?" I think there's a purpose for that early in Jesus' ministry. He's not ready to be mobbed. But certainly there are times when he performs a miracle that people are drawn to him. But let me say this. Generally, it is a miracle of healing of someone. And this is a miracle of healing, but it's a different miracle of healing. In the case of the blind, the lame, that is a natural process that people recognize and Jesus fixed it. This is sinister. This is frightening. This is the guy who runs naked through town, lives down in the tomb, eats out of the garbage pails, you know, screams and has fits and is thrown around and the little children run from him because it just scares him to death. This is sinister. Now, was he healed? Yep, he was. And that's the way it's characterized. That's the way he recognized it. But this is the unexplainable. You can't get your arms around this one. It's not just someone who happened to be born blind. We get that. We understand that. And so when Jesus, I think here's the logic on the part of the people who witnessed this. And this is a great example of the power of God over mysticism, over this concept of mysticism. Even when here, it actually existed. It's not just something we've made up in novels. It actually is there. And so, you've got Jesus having power over that. In this case, unlike healing cases, in this case, it scares them to death because, stop and think about it. What's the conclusion? If this thing that has frightened us all this time, we got this wild man living over here in our town, and this man from Nazareth has power over that, my tiny mind starts flowing with logic that says he's more powerful than the scary thing that bugs me, that bothers me, that frightens me. He's even more powerful than that. I want to tell you, I think if we were going to have a theme to this lesson of Christ's superiority over mysticism, this example is a great place. He had power. And let me also say, I want you to notice the conversation. It's not the conversation between Jesus and the man. It's a conversation between Jesus and the demons that possessed him. He's out of the loop. He's just the carrier right now. I want you to notice the conversation that occurs between them. When he saw Jesus, when the man, he cried out, fell down before him in a loud voice. Now this is the demon speak. "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." The demons recognize the incompatibility of evil with righteousness, with God and Satan. They recognize the incompatibility. But I also want you to notice this. They too were scared. They too were scared. They were concerned about You know, they recognize, you know, yep, they're scary, but they recognize where all authority really flows from. They recognize where all power really flows from. It is a degree of who are we scared of the most. You know, there is a great story that has gone around our part of the country about a little boy. A little boy whose daily chore was to go in, get the chickens, get the eggs out of the chicken coop, but there was a rooster in there that would always come after him every day. And he came to his dad and he kind of complained about it, and his dad was like, "Son, your job is to go get those eggs, you figure it out." And so the little boy finally rolled up a newspaper and he launched in there and did battle with the rooster, got the eggs and came out, and his mama asked him about it later and he said, "I decided I was more afraid of daddy than I was that rooster." And I think that's the case here. They were more afraid of daddy than they were the rooster. They recognize from where it is power flows. They understand. Now that needs to be an enormous faith, a point of faith building for us. Our Savior, we need not fear. I understand people have natural fear. I get that. But we need not have fear over things that we, you know, like these folks are afraid of these demons. We need not fear those things. These demons that the local community was scared of, they recognize the power is really right over there in Jesus. It's not here with us. The power is really right over there. That's where authority reigns. That is the superior power. It is not in mysticism. It is not in the power of Satan. It is in the power of God. And so they even recognize that in this situation. Because you can tell that they're worried. Don't torment me. They know who can hurt them. And so again, I think that is comforting. It is empowering. There are things we don't need to be afraid of. Because the power and the authority of Christ is superior to mysticism. It's better than that. There are things we don't have to be concerned with. As this text continues, and again, the people's response is pretty quick. Again, if we're scared of the demons, and this man can control those demons. And we'll come back and because I will see an example where the conclusion of people was, if you can cast out demons, you must be the chief demon. And we're going to go and consider that in just a minute. And see where that's inconsistent. But again, in this, there is the fright that happens with that. But now notice the reaction to the man. Let's go back to the individual who was healed. Much like the proconsul in the case of Paul in Acts 13, notice the reaction in this man. Now everybody else, seized with great fear, they kind of scatter. And again, word's going to get out, but they kind of scatter. But now the man remains. I've always imagined this as it was kind of pandemonium there for a moment with the hogs running wild and down the hill and into the water and demons hollering and you just kind of get this image of chaos for a moment. Scares the crowd to death, you know, they're gone, but now there is this quiet moment just with Jesus and the man in whom he had healed. And I like these moments. I think these personal moments are important for us. I think we need to have these moments with Jesus. Just the two of them, as best we can understand. Verse 38. Now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him. Can you imagine the relief on the part of this man? Can you imagine the relief of the burden that is gone from this man? He was overwhelmed. This is a case. You know, I make a strong case for people as I have worked with different people wrestling with different sin and temptation in their life. I do not buy into the idea that we can't conquer it. I don't buy into that. You might need more help. You might need even professional help. You might even need medical help to overcome sin in your life, depending on what it is. But you can overcome it. I don't buy into the idea that the devil made me do it. I was presented with a choice and I made the wrong one. That's not this man's case. Here you do have a case where the devil made him do it. Where he is overwhelmed. Where he is possessed. It is not his decision to be like this. He is overwhelmed by a power he has no control over. You think that he would beg Jesus, "Let me stay with you. You are my new hero. Let me stay with you." So what is, you know, now notice what Jesus says. Jesus sent him away. Now that might on the surface seem a little bit calloused. But there is a method to what Jesus is doing. He sent him away. He says, "Return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you." Who do you give credit to? Wouldn't it be easy? Matter of fact, and we see this on a few cases. We see this in the case where the sorcerer wants to buy from the apostles the power to perform miracles. He knew what that was worth. That'll make you a famous man quick. That'll make you a rich man quick. He knew what he was doing. But yet, here you have Jesus. You have the Son of God sending this man away. Return to your house. Go back to your life. But when you go, what I want you to do is I want you to tell the great things, not that I have done for you. Now look, I'm not refuting the idea of the Godhead. I get it. He is the Son within the Godhead. I understand that. But where does He give credit to? He gives credit to the proper source, to the ultimate source from which authority and power and salvation flows. He says, "Go tell what God has done for you." And I think that's probably what this fellow did. It would be hard to keep this story to yourself. I just imagine the people who were the recipients of this miracle. Again, we see it a couple times. But in this man, after that miserable life, and you have laid down this load, and now my life, this is such a small example, but it happened to me a few years ago. I am a big baby when it comes to a toothache. Now, I've got a pretty high tolerance for all other kinds of pain. But the mildest toothache will just send me running wild. I don't know what it is, but I can't take it. And a few years ago, I had a bad one. And as it always happens, you know, it happens, seems like, on a Saturday night, and the dentist's not open, you know. And it's one of those deals. And I had to suffer with it for a day or two. And I'll tell you, when I came out of that dentist's office, you know, and he had, you know, numbed everything from here down, that was just, what a weight that is gone. Walk out of the dentist's office, numbness goes away, you're back in business. Whoa, man, for two or three days, I was just on cloud nine. Can you imagine how a man had suffered with demonic possession feels when he leaves, and the impression now that God has control. I mean, the dawning on him of that God has control over demons. God's the power. It's not mysticism. It's not the devil. It's not all of these other things that we think go bump in the night. God controls all that. He's in charge of all that. I don't have to be worried about that any longer. What a liberation this is, and an empowerment for this man. Questions or comments before we move on? All right, go to Matthew chapter 12. This is where we're going to spend the balance of our, 15 minutes or so here. Now, in Matthew chapter 12, we're going to pick up just right here in verse 22 in just a moment. Again, with the idea of a demon-possessed man. Because, again, to be fair to those who witness it, you might misunderstand, because if you agree that this man that you see before you is demon-possessed, and someone comes along and controls that, what might be your logical and your natural conclusion? He's the head demon. He's in charge. Now let me say, the conclusion that he's in charge is correct. But it's what is our perspective. Is he in charge because he is powerful and he is the enemy of these demons, or are the demons working for him? That's the question. In this case, they come, those that witness it come to the wrong conclusion. And Jesus deals with that flawed logic in this example. So let's look in verse 22. Then one was brought to him who was demon possessed, blind and mute, and he healed him, so that the blind and the mute man both spoke and saw, and all the multitude were amazed and said, could this be the son of David? And we'll stop right there and notice something. The prudent folks in the audience, I think you've got to watch this in Jesus' interaction with particularly the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes and the Pharisees have an agenda. They've got a reason they don't want Jesus to be successful. Because Jesus is not the kind of Messiah, son of David, that they were looking for. He's not going to support their agenda. They had a preconceived notion about him. He doesn't meet that. We got to get this guy out of the way. It's going to cost us if we don't. So they always miss the point. The prudent folks here, folks with a pure heart, they are excellent students of Old Testament prophecy. They are living in a time where there is an air of expectancy for the Messiah to return. There had been many before Jesus claiming to be that Messiah who had fallen by the wayside. They see this miracle and they ask the question, maybe this is Him. Now let me say, that's the question it was supposed to bring out. That was the purpose of these miracles, is to make these people begin to consider, this is the Son of God. This is it. This is the one we really have been waiting on. Verse 24, now when the Pharisees heard it, they said, remember, they've got an agenda. They've got an axe to grind. Early on, they went out and investigated Jesus. When they figured out Jesus had in His mind this notion of some kind of spiritual kingdom and not a theocracy back in Jerusalem, kick the Romans out, give us back our land, and look, that, you know, it's 2012, people are still talking about this kind of thing. That's what they look, and so they can't let this sit, and they certainly don't want Him developing followers. And so their response is, this fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the rulers of the demons. In other words, the reason he can control the demons is not because he's the Son of God. The reason he can control the demons is because he's the boss demon. He's doing it by the power of the devil. He's working for the guy. Now that's obviously going to get the attention of a devout Jew. They don't want anything to do with that. That's going to get their attention. But notice Jesus' response. Jesus knew their thoughts. Now, let's think about this for a second. Wouldn't it be impressive if you're the Pharisee and you might have said it over here, but Jesus is reading your mail? But they still don't get it. Jesus knows their thoughts. He's not just responding to their verbal argumentation like you and I might. Jesus is reading their mail. And so His response back, and it's a very logical one, it makes complete sense, and when He says it, you're like, yeah. Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself will not stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will His kingdom stand? That is profound in its simplicity. And if you're thinking it, that's right. Abraham Lincoln doesn't get credit for that one. Jesus does. Abe borrowed it. But Jesus says, how can that be? Why, if I'm working for Satan, would I bind him? Why would I do that? That's not the point. The point is, Jesus is making, is I'm working for God. He's the one who has power over this. Now later in this, I want to point this out as a point of practical application. Stay in chapter 12, but skip down to verse 43. And this is mentioned a couple of places. So here we live in this world where mysticism seems to be everywhere around us. You know, it seems to be prevalent. The supernatural, the occult, all kinds of stuff. It's present and it's there. So what do we do about all of this? Is it good enough just to take the occult, mysticism, you know, interest in all of that kind of stuff and just set it aside and say, well, you know what, I'm not involved in all of that. So let's think about that in a means of practical application. And again, the superiority of Christ over that. In verse 43, Jesus makes this point. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, I will return to my house from which I come. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation. Let me tell you what I think Christ is trying to convey to them in that text. I think what he's saying is that, look, it's one thing to get rid of the evil spirits. It's one thing to get rid of what trips you up and leave the house empty. You think to yourself, I'm not involved in that. I'm not involved in mysticism. I've kept it at arm's length. I'm not, you know, I don't give in to that kind of thing. Here's Jesus' point. If you don't fill that empty space up, it's a vacuum. If you don't fill that empty space up with something, something's going to flow back into it, and it's very likely that the end state's going to be worse than the beginning. And he uses that example. The demon is cast out. He goes home. There's the house. It's cleaned up. It's swept. Everything is set in order. Nothing is occupying this space. He goes out and gets seven friends and says, come with me. I found us a new hangout. We'll go live there. And the end state was worse than when you just had one demon hanging around. I think Jesus' application is, it's not good enough to get rid of Satan. It's not good enough to keep him at an arm's length. If you don't fill the space of your soul with Jesus Christ, the end state could be worse because that vacuum's eventually going to fill with something. I can't attribute this. I don't know who said this. I hope it's true, but if it's not, you can credit me with saying it. And, you know, I'll finally be able to say I coined a phrase. Somebody once made the point, there is a God-shaped hole in every human spirit. A God-shaped hole. And I think that's the point of this little parable that Jesus uses. You can get the demons out. It's not going to be lasting, it's not good enough if you don't fill that God-shaped hole. And just like a round peg in a round hole, there's only one shape that will fill it. You can, just like Ecclesiastes that we looked at on Friday night, you can try to fill that hole up with other stuff. You can try to fill it up with fun. You can try to fill it up with recreation and pleasure or accomplishment or what, you know, all the things we talked about on Friday night. Here's the problem. The hole is shaped only like God. Only God can fit into that space and fill it. And so I do, again, that's an important point that Jesus is making. It's not good enough to get rid of the demon. You have to fill the space so that he can't come back. The space is filled by God. Christ is superior to mysticism. We're not going to find our answers there. That's not going to fill that hole. And let's face it, we are bombarded by it all of the time. It is, you know, spiritualism, and at least if you've got some concept of a higher being, That hole cannot be filled by other spiritualizations. That hole can only be filled by God. So, thank you for your attention.